You have this?
Oh, you do, okay.
Okay, first thing to please you all. Survival of the fittest, you know? I mean, the women are always here first and they'll stay the longest. That's, you know. Okay, first thing to say is that next week there is no class, just to remind you. There's no lecture, at least, right? That means also there's no seminar. So the seminar for this lecture will occur
on the 18th, I believe.
Yes.
Yes, okay. So just to, because I know how diligent at least those of you who show up are, there is no lecture next week. It's the reading week for our department. Okay? Now, what I want to do today on the course outline is to talk about the relationship between the social and the natural sciences. But of course, I want to hook up with what we talked about last time, which had to do with evolution and Darwinism and so forth. And what I want to do here is to stress more explicitly what makes Darwinism scientific. Because in a sense, last time, I was talking mostly about the way in which Darwinism and evolution more generally relate to various kinds of religious worldviews and political worldviews and so forth. But now let's look at the scientific character of the theory, because that will give us some understanding about whether social science can be considered scientific. Okay, first thing to keep in mind is that Darwin never considered himself a scientist. Okay, he called himself a naturalist. He had a first degree from Cambridge, but in fact, he was a man of inherited wealth, and he unsuccessfully studied a medical degree at one point, but basically spent the rest of his life living off his inheritance, and, you know, basically studying nature at whatever pace he felt like it. Except towards the end, in the mid-1850s, he began to realize that other people were beginning to come up with theories of evolution like the one he was talking about to his various friends over the years. So he then expedited publication of Origin of Species, 1859. Okay, now this book is largely a book about observations made of different plants and animals. Many he himself had done, because he took this great voyage around the world on the ship the Beagle in the 1830s when he was a young man, and wrote a book about it, actually, early on in his career. But also compiling observations of other naturalists throughout the world. That's what the book, that's kind of the bulk of the book is of that character. That's to say, there is not a lot of general heavy-duty explanatory concepts brought in. So for example, if you read Karl Marx, and Marx's accounts of capitalist economy, one of the things you immediately notice is that there's a lot of technical language. Marx throws a lot of philosophical jargon, a lot of economic stuff, right? I mean, the man is almost impenetrable in places, and the only thing that makes Marx kind of comprehensible is the fact that there are so many commentaries on Marx, right? So very rarely you have to go to Marx first, right? You can go to somebody else first who gives you kind of idiot's guide, and then you, at some point, if you really feel bold, you might look at Marx, okay? Darwin's completely different in this respect. Darwin was, in fact, a kind of popular writer. I mean, you have to think of him as having an audience comparable to the kind of audience that maybe somebody like Richard Dawkins would have today. Okay? So, in other words, this is a guy whose books could be read straight. Didn't need commentaries, didn't need professors, kind of, you know, telling you why this is important because you couldn't figure it out for yourself. Right? This is a book, you know, where its meaning is pretty clear because it's mostly descriptive. It's mostly describing how animals and plants behave in the natural world. And then what he's doing is he's trying to come up with some general account that's common to all those creatures. But the account itself, which is where natural selection comes in, right, that these creatures have the kinds of shapes they have the kinds of character they have the kinds of behaviors they have because of adaptations to the environment, that's the basic story, right, that's natural selection. That enters really as just a kind of general covering concept to show you, you know, to kind of sensitize the reader as to what all these different things have in common. What Darwin does not do, okay, is Darwin doesn't explain how it happens. What he does suggest, however, is that it could happen given a long enough period of time just through normal reproductive processes of organisms facing changes in the environment. In other words, he said, and this is what natural selection is all about, basically, you can give an account of how you have this entire array, this diversity of species, right, as if you assume that the Earth's been around for millions of years, that the processes involved in the changes between species are the kinds of changes that you can see happening today. So in other words, Darwin has no room for miracles, no room for God or anything like that. He doesn't say he disproves miracles or God, right? He just says it's not necessary if you give enough time for these chance-based processes to, as it were, engage in a kind of biological trial and error. Right? So you've got to imagine every organism, when it reproduces, there's a probability range of different kinds of offspring you can have. Of course, it will be within a fairly narrow range, so it, you know, humans will beget humans, right? Not something beyond that. But the types of humans, the kinds of characteristics, there is a range, and depending on the environment, some of them might be better suited to survive in that new environment than others. And Darwin believes that process, over a very long period of time, that produces all of the diversity of nature. That's the argument of the book. Okay? The problem is, though, it's a hypothesis that he has no idea of causation. Right? So, for example, Darwin knows nothing about genetics. Because genetics is going to be a very important issue here, right? Because genetics is going to explain the variation within the organism. So, you know, what is exactly the range of offspring you can have if two humans mate? Right? I mean, Darwin, you know, in a sense, you kind of knew from experience, but he didn't have a causal explanation as to why the range is as it is. You know, in other words, why is it that when two humans reproduce, they don't produce a cow? He couldn't explain that, because he didn't have a theory of genetics. Okay? Simple as that. Everybody, of course, assumed that he was kind of right, but nobody could explain it. Okay? So in that respect, a very crucial aspect of what science is about, which is to say to establish causation, right? What causes what? How are things brought about? Darwin could not explain. What Darwin hypothesized was, it is possible this could have arisen through natural processes without God. Which natural processes? I don't know. That's Darwin's argument. So now you see, what he does here in this book is he kind of opens a space for science, right? Because now there's something to investigate, right? You have to say, well, okay, let's say we were to operate on this assumption that all of this diversity in nature is caused through all these natural processes happening over millions of years. Well then, what's the cause? Right? And so you then, this is where you start to do genetics. Now as it turns out, in Darwin's own day, there was a man who was in fact dealing with this question, and that was Gregor Mendel. People have heard of him? Mendel, he is the founder of genetics. He was a monk, Augustinian monk, Catholic, right, in Moravia, which is now part of the Czech Republic. And Mendel grew peas very famously and studied the patterns of reproduction and came up with some mathematical formula which he basically thought would explain the range of variance in offspring. So in other words, he got it down to a kind of like laws, like something a bit like Newton's laws. Okay. So he's writing around the same time as Darwin. He sent his papers to Darwin. Darwin couldn't make any sense of them. First of all, Darwin didn't know much about mathematics. Darwin was a pure naturalist, very what we call qualitative researcher, right? Mendel also wrote in German, which was a great disadvantage to the single language Darwin. Okay, it was easy for Darwin to get around the world back in those days because, of course, Britain owned everything, so folks could travel freely. But Darwin was only knew English. Okay, so Mendel, so you go to Darwin. Darwin's library, and there's Mendel's papers that he sent Darwin, and the pages are uncut. Because, you know, back in the old days, you had to cut the pages before you could read them. So Darwin, obviously, after you look at the first page, he said, I'm not going to be able to make it through this. Okay? So, point here is, there's a certain kind of way of looking at nature, which we would now call a very scientific way, which involves experimentation and mathematics and so forth, and aims at kind of general laws of causation, that in a way was very alien to Darwin's way of thinking. Okay, so he ignored this guy Mendel. Now, for the first 50 years of Origin of Species, so until 1909, basically, Darwinism was very influential in the way that Freudianism or Marxism has been influential, namely as a kind of ideological position, which some people took to have scientific merit, but others did not. They just took it as pure ideology. And so you get like social Darwinism, right? Survival of the fittest. You may recall, right in the last class, I was remarking about how Herbert Spencer thought that welfare programs would be a waste of time, right, because basically all you're doing is you're artificially maintaining a population, in this case of poor people, who are unfit, because if they were fit, they wouldn't be poor, okay? And so, as a result, the natural thing to do is to just let them die off, and then they don't reproduce anymore. But if you keep these people alive, then you just set yourself up for more problems in the future, because they just keep on reproducing, okay? Now, one of the things, from a scientific standpoint, that's problematic about Spencer's view is Spencer didn't know anything more about genetics than Darwin did. So what is he talking, you know, what is the causal underpinning of this argument when he gets right down to it? Okay? All he's got are statistics, you know, talking about the reproductive patterns of the rich and the poor over time and so forth. But what he doesn't have is any kind of causal story as to why these patterns exist. And as you know, correlation is not causation. You learned this in methods course, and it applies here too. Okay? So the point here is that getting a kind of causal understanding of how exactly genetic mechanisms work to be able to produce the spread in the population that we see is really important for being able to sort out a lot of these conclusions that have very strong political consequences, right, that people were making on the back of Darwinism. Now this happens, you start to get some scientific closure on this in the early 20th century. And basically what happens is that you begin to get a group of people who are educated both in the sort of naturalistic techniques that Darwin knew, you know, observing animals in the wild basically, right? And also lab-based geneticists. Now if you're doing genetics, you got to think about this, right? Genetics is a laboratory science. It's a very artificial science. It's very much like physics, right? It deals, in a way, with genes and organisms as abstract objects. And they're looking for relationships between things. So what you typically want to do when you're doing genetics is you want to work with a relatively uncomplicated organism as your test site, right? You don't want an organism with lots of different characteristics that might be caused by many different combinations of genes. You want simple things. So the thing, the fruit fly, right? The fruit fly. This is like the great lingua franca of genetics in the early 20th century. Fruit flies. First of all, they're easy to get a hold of, right? Just go to any kind of place where you can make wine, fermentable products, right? You'll find fruit flies everywhere, right? So they're easy to get a hold of. They reproduce massively and quickly, so you can cycle through generations of these things very easily. And so if you're able to kind of zero in on their genes, or their chromosomes at least, which is what holds the genes, right, you are then able to make some manipulations to see, okay, well, supposing this changes, that changes. And their environments are relatively simple environments, so you can reproduce them easily in the laboratory. So you cycle through all these many different generations of fruit flies, and you start to get some scientific regularities about how genetics works, operating on the assumption that, you know, fruit fly genes, right, are, you know, they may have fewer genes than we do, the genes may be coded somewhat differently, but they're made of the same stuff as our genes are, Though, of course, in the early 20th century, nobody knew about DNA, so nobody knew exactly what was this common stuff they were made of. But that was an assumption that was made pretty early on. Okay? So the geneticists are clearly doing something that looks like science, and not surprisingly, that people who were involved in the early days of genetics, and this includes Mendel, by the way, were people typically schooled in physics and chemistry, not necessarily in what we would call, you know, the main, you know, like a kind of proper biological science like zoology or botany or something like that, right? They tend to be from physics and chemistry, and they tend to have that kind of mentality toward things. Well, what you start to get in the early 20th century is you get a whole bunch of people who are basically trained in both areas, and so they actually engage in the project of trying to make Darwinism scientific by coming up with some kind of causal mechanistic story. And the main guy, who's a very fascinating figure in lots of different ways, is this guy Dobzhansky. Now Dobzhansky was a big professor at Columbia University in America, which is where the major American initiatives on genetics were taken in the early 20th century. Dobzhansky came originally from the Ukraine, and he was someone who, when he was living in the Russian Empire, was trained in a kind of naturalistic methods, similar to Darwin. But then when he moved to the United States, when the Russian Revolution happened, he went to the lab of the leading geneticist in the United States, which was at Columbia, and basically took over his lab once that guy retired. Now, Dobzhansky was a very influential public figure as well in the United States. In fact, he was the president of the American Eugenics Society, and one of the things that he did, and Dobzhansky only died in like 1973 or something, okay, so this guy lived a long, you know, he was alive through most of the 20th century. That Dobzhansky introduced a term that is now very much, he introduced ideas of genetic counseling, which we now hear a lot about these days, and he also introduced this phrase, which in a way was meant to be a kind of soft focus replacement for racism, genetic diversity. You may know about this phrase, genetic diversity. The idea that we need genetic diversity. Back in the old days, one would say one needs multiple races. Okay. So Dobzhansky, basically what he tried to do there was he was trying to, as it were, normalize, right, for a public that was scared of fascism and, you know, totalitarianism and all the rest of it, a kind of acceptance of genetics as part of normal public culture, medical discourse, so forth. Okay? Now, Dobzhansky wrote this book, very famous book, which is like the book that really makes Darwinism into a science. Genetics and the Origin of Species. And this book comes out in 1937, and it is one of the most influential books ever written in the history of science. Because what it did was, it was written in such a way that the geneticists, most of whom were trained in physics and chemistry, and, you know, had worked in quantitative methods and so forth, they could see the relevance of what they're doing to what these naturalists are doing, and vice versa. So, you know, so the point, you got people who come from really, you know, radically different backgrounds. Now, I'm stressing this point here because this has relevance to the social sciences and in particular sociology. Because, you know, in the brief time that you people have been studying sociology, one of the things that you have probably noticed is that there is this difference between qualitative and quantitative research, right? And there's a lot of stuff written about this difference. And very often, the stuff written about it gives you the impression that never the twain shall meet, right? They are radically different, right? They access the world in radically different ways. If you're one, you can't be the other. The one invalidates the other even. Right? A lot of qualitative researchers act as if, can't believe statistics, gross generalizations, blah, blah, blah. Quantitative researchers say in return, qualitative research, what is this? Just sort of subjective hocus pocus. Everybody makes it up as they go along. What is this? Right? So you got mutual suspicion on both sides. You may have even encountered this in your courses or in your readings, okay?
This is a deep-seated problem in the social sciences.
This is where Dobzhansky looks really smart, because he bridges it within biology. Because biology, at the beginning of the 20th century, is very much like social science, where you've got the qualitative guys and the quantitative guys. The qualitative guys are like Darwin. They look at animals in the field and nature, and they make kind of hypotheses based on what they see. They don't have any sense of mathematics. They don't have any sense of rigorous laboratory-based experimentation or anything of that sort. They're kind of ecologically minded, you might say. On the other hand, the genetics people, experiments, preferably with controls, artificial environments, right? So like with a fruit fly, the thing about the fruit fly is you can turn it into a reproduction machine. You can just generate multiple offsprings, multiple generations, and then test them for various things. Nothing like nature at all. You're basically treating the biology as if it were a kind of motor. Right? That's the way the geneticists go about looking at things. These are radically different worldviews, okay? And what Dobzhansky does in Genetics and the Origin of Species is to put them together. And in fact, it's as a result of this that you get, you know, when we talk about the state of biology today, we talk about this thing called the Neo-Darwinian synthesis. Okay? So the neo part has to do with the fact that genetics, Mendel, gets brought into Darwin through Dobzhansky. Okay? And so you get a synthesis. So the idea being that all those animals and plants that you see out in the field from as a qualitative researcher, what they are doing is basically engaging in processes that you can study in more detail and more closely in the laboratory. Okay? Now, this is something very much taken for granted today in biology. Okay? So, for example, one of the things that goes on when one wants to demonstrate natural selection, say, well, look, natural selection happens. Well, but according to Darwin, natural selection is something that happens over millions, maybe even billions of years in a slow, incremental way. I mean, don't you have to, like, rewind the history to be able to determine whether or not this thing's actually happening? Because isn't he talking about a kind of historical process, natural selection? That's certainly what Darwin sounded like he was saying. But nowadays, people don't interpret natural selection quite this way. They don't deny what Darwin said, but they say you can also demonstrate natural selection in the lab. In other words, you can somehow induce natural selection. You can manipulate some organisms, like fruit flies, whatever, and then the results of the offspring, right, demonstrate natural selection. So natural selection can be shown now. Now this is interesting. I think Darwin would it'd be interesting to see what, you know, too bad we can't bring Darwin back and see what he would think about this. But it is an interesting feature about the way in which what happens when you get the Neo-Darwinian synthesis is that a lot of concepts that Darwin used for a purely historical purpose, you know, as it were, a historical account. Natural selection is a historical account of how life has developed on Earth over millions of years. That is what Origin of Species is about. Okay? He didn't think of it as something like Newton's laws, where in a sense it's kind of operating the same way everywhere now, you can demonstrate it, kind of thing. It's not clear he believed that. But this is what, in fact, the biologists believe today. Okay. So, for example, you could demonstrate natural selection in a lab. You can demonstrate natural selection on a computer, running through artificial life programs. You can demonstrate natural selection all kinds of ways nowadays. Okay? Because it's now got this kind of general, universal character to it. I mean, to give you a sense of what this would be like if we were talking about the social sciences, think about Marxism for a moment. All right? Marxism gives you an account of, let's say, the transition from feudalism to capitalism to socialism. Right? Now, what kind of an account is that? This so-called historical materialist account, as he called it. It is an account about history. Right? It's an account about history. follow? If it isn't an account about history, and let's assume it's true for the moment, does it follow it's something you can demonstrate in the lab? Or does it require very specific conditions to be in place, which were in fact in place historically, to enable this to happen? But can that just immediately be transferred to a lab? Well, I think most social scientists would say no. Right, that there's a sense in which the historical character of this development is kind of essential to what it is. Now, I should say, in the history of Marxism, there's a very active debate about all this, okay? And this has a lot to do with the fact that, of course, people were keen on getting to socialism before they completed capitalism. And as you think about the, you know, Marx himself thought that given his own, the logic of his own theory, that the first place to have the revolution should be the place with the largest labor movement. Right? I mean, that would be the idea. You'd have, you know, a place that's most advanced in terms of capitalism, so there's a well-developed labor movement, and then what these people would be increasingly alienated from the means of production, especially as technology took over more and more of the labor process. That was kind of Marx's view. So Marx predicted the revolution would happen in Germany. Didn't happen there, did it? It happened in Russia. Now, how did it happen in Russia? Well, it didn't happen in Russia because Lenin was sitting around waiting for capitalism to develop sufficiently in Russia so then it could be triggered into socialism. No, Lenin decided to fast forward a bit. Right? So in other words, Lenin had much more of a laboratory mentality about Marxism. Right? In other words, that there's a sense in which you can intervene in the process and you can kind of make it happen artificially. Right, that's a very key part about the way in which, in fact, Marxism spread throughout the world. Because the countries that have, in fact, taken on board Marxism, right, or took it on board most successfully, were not the most advanced from a capitalistic standpoint. In fact, many of them still had very large agricultural economies, as the Soviet Union, of course, did. Okay, and so then the idea becomes, well, what exactly, in what sense is then this based on Marxism? Well, some sort of abstract version of Marxism, obviously, where in some sense, you don't have to wait for history actually to take its course, but that there's a kind of way in which you can make it happen, that there's a method you can make it happen. And Lenin writes a lot about this, about the method by which you induce a revolution. How do you have to get people organized? How do you have to have politics going for you, economics going for you? And how all of this has to be brought together, but it's something you can induce. Very much like a laboratory experimenter would do, inducing a mutation in an organism to see what happens. Okay? That's the way Lenin and all these Marxists who actually had some political impact operated. They would make revolutions happen. They wouldn't wait for the revolution to happen. Okay? And of course now, you know, if you know something about the history of Marxism, enormous debates continue to this day about whether guys like Lenin were really Marxists, you know, were they really good Marxists, you know, the proper Marxists, or were they just bad guys, you know, who caused misery under the name of Marx, right? And you know, it's easy to have these arguments now, in a way. Anyway, it wasn't so easy 50 years ago. Well, see, Darwin, this kind of argument never really happened in terms of biology. I mean, Dobzhansky sealed the deal, okay? So he actually basically got the naturalists, you know, who basically are studying the development of life on Earth, who study fossils, who study living organisms in their natural habitats, he got them to basically agree that what the guys were doing in the lab under the rubric of natural selection was exactly the same thing they were studying in the field. Same thing. What happens in the lab is what happens in the field. No difference. Now you think about that. There, you know, in any field of the social sciences that has both a strong lab component and a strong field component, so not just sociology, but psychology, right, these disciplines never agree on this point. You would never get a social scientist saying, well, you know, if you show it in the lab, it therefore happens in the field. Or if you see it in the field, it'll therefore happen in the lab, right? I mean, people always assume that there is some complexity, right, that enters into the issue, so that a laboratory environment may have abstracted away certain variables that are crucial for the effect to be brought about in the field. And vice versa. Okay? And in fact, one of the reasons why the social sciences, I don't know if you realize this, but if you look at all of the books that are written on the scientific method, they are written mostly by social scientists, not by natural scientists. Okay? This is a very important point. And in fact, if you want to go to the most sophisticated works on scientific methodology, I would suggest you go and look at works in social psychology. That is where it's most sophisticated, social psychology. Okay? Now, why is this? Well, because these are the fields where there is the sharpest awareness of the difference that different methods make to the kinds of data you can generate. I mean, a point that you probably learned in your first research methods lecture is one that in fact motivates people to think deeply about methodology. Namely, if you pick up the data in different means, you know, there are going to be some implications there. You can't read them straight. And you certainly can't translate across different methods easily. Okay? So this is very much taken for granted in the social sciences. But in the natural sciences, this is not so taken for granted. And in biology, after Dobzhansky's work, the deal was sealed. And so the laboratory guys and the guys who do field work came to see themselves as working on the same project, common biological project. So nowadays, you may know, you think about how do you tell I mentioned last time in the class the tree of life, right? This kind of account that's implicit in Darwin's work, whereby, you know, you start off with a simple organism, and then over time through natural selection, you get the diversity of nature, with some things dying off and other things coming into being, and you get like this tree formation that doesn't lead anywhere, but just gets more and more exfoliated, okay? Well, how do you study this phenomenon, which is a primarily historical phenomenon about the history of the Earth? Well, you can say, let's look at fossils, right? I mean, there were some fossils around when Darwin was living, a lot more now. Study the fossils. You can do this thing called radiometric dating. That's to say, you look for the trace elements, right, from the organisms that used to live in the fossils, and you can date them that way, because these elements have half-lives of certain millions of years, and so you can calculate these things. So that's using a kind of physics-based technique to figure out the order and the timing of life forms on Earth. But then the other way you do it, and this is the thing that DNA enables, right, so now we move from the field to the lab, right, we get this business of the so-called molecular clock. Molecular clock. And the idea is that if you compare the DNAs of two organisms, right, you look at where they differ from each other. Because most organisms, animals, 90% of the genomes are common. For all animals, and with when you start moving into primates, we're talking 97-98%. So you can zero in on the differences very easily when you're looking at these genomes that have all these, enormous length to them. You just look for where the differences are. And by looking at differences from a range of species, you can indicate when a common when they sort of split off. So in other words, let's say you've got species 1, species 2, species 3, and you look at the differences in their DNA, and you can tell, for example, whether 1 and 2 split off after 3 split off from some common ancestor. And this is just by looking at the DNA without actually, looking at the DNA right now of the organisms. So we can talk about living organisms and figure out their biological ages this way. Now, this is a radically different way of doing it. It basically, so in other words, you're treating DNA as a kind of living historical record. So in other words, the DNA, in a sense, is being read as an archival document of where the organism came from in evolutionary time. Right, so you read that's what the molecular clock hypothesis is. Okay, so you read the DNA like a document almost, so the organism carries inside of it saying when it was manufactured. But that's a different way of doing it. Right, this is a very lab-based technique. It works on living organisms in the lab. very different than taking a fossil of a dead organism, which actually did live millions of years ago, and then trying to figure out, based on trace elements in the fossils, how old it is. Darwin's theory of evolution, in its new form, says these two things will be the same. In other words, the results you get through this method and the results you'll get from the other method will coincide, and so you'll end up with one tree of life. Now, it's not so simple as it turns out. There are some contradictions. They don't quite give you the same answers. Okay? But the point is that the scientists working in the neo-Darwinian synthesis take it for granted that there will be some convergence here. Right? So that whatever differences do exist, they're presumed to be resolvable. In other words, they don't suppose that the molecular clock hypothesis has nothing to do with fossil. They presume they're about the same things. And that you will get some kind of common understanding of how life developed on Earth. Okay. Now again, this is a remarkable kind of assumption from a social science standpoint. Okay. Because from a social science standpoint, why should you suppose, for example, that an account of how human beings have been historically, which you learn about by, you know, studying their records, you know, studying them anthropologically, looking at the sites where they lived and so forth, why should that end up giving you the same account of human beings as you get from a laboratory experiment conducted now? It's true that all of us who might be participants in a lab experiment, in a sense, from a genetic standpoint, carry, right, information that our ancestors provided us, which is inscribed in our genes. All that is true. But in social sciences, we would never take that as sufficient reason for thinking that the results in the lab should match the results of history. We would assume they will just go wherever they go. Okay. Even though, obviously, we're talking about human beings in all cases. Now, the thing that's always made it very difficult for social scientists to grant that there might be these multiple methods converging on some sort of common understanding of, in this case, social reality, is this idea, and this is an idea that goes back to Weber's day. Have any of you read any of Weber's methodological writings? Because of the social scientists, you know, you're likely to study, Weber is the one who really is on top of this point that I'm talking about here. And this is a distinction. Again, I'm going to have to throw some Greek at you here, but that's the way they were doing things in Germany 100 years ago. When in doubt, speak Greek. And so, have any of you ever run across this distinction, nomothetic, ideographic?
In A-level psychology, they mention it.
Okay, good, good, good. I'm glad. Because this is very relevant to this, to what I'm going to talk about here, as to what makes it difficult for the social sciences to integrate information from using different methods. The nomothetic basically comes from the Greek nomos for law. So this is the generalizing, universalizing tendency. The kind of thing you'd associate with laws of physics and stuff like that, right? And when you do laboratory research in the social sciences, you know, you want to know how people behave under various conditions and so forth, you're typically oriented toward this nomothetic approach, right? In other words, you're looking for things of maximum generalizability. And that's why you want to kind of abstract away all the things that might make the particular individual unique. And this is always interesting in a social psychology experiment. Because in social psychology experiments, people have to be interacting with each other in the experiment. It's not just looking at an isolated individual, but people are interacting with each other. But you don't want everything, every characteristic of the people interacting in the experiment to come into play. Because that would just, then you'd never know how to interpret the results. So you have to somehow abstract away aspects of the social situation and just focus on the ones that you want to study. It's very tricky. And that's why social psychology is the field that actually has the most sophisticated literature on scientific methods. Because that's, in a way, the trickiest problem of all. If you want to come up with some universal generalizations about social life, and you're studying people in a lab together interacting, right, there are potentially loads of ways in which the results can be confused and confounded, depending on the particularities of the two people, or the three people, or whatever. So you have to somehow control for that. And that's what, you know, experimental method is all about. So, for example, you know, people will only be able to interact in certain prescribed ways. They'll be asked particular questions, or be told to talk about very specific things. They'll be told not to bring up certain things. Or, in some cases, they might be given roles. Right? So, in other words, drop your old identity, pick up this new identity, and see how, what happens. Okay? So that's the nomothetic approach. Now, the thing, that though, is that it's very distinct about the social sciences, and what has always been the tricky part that has prevented, you might say, the social sciences from becoming like the biological sciences did in the 20th century, is the second one, ideographic. Now, ideographic comes from ideos, which has to do with unique, individual. So, nomothetic is like a generalizing, universalizing tendency. Ideographic is the individualizing, particularizing tendency. That's to say, where you're interested in the unique situation of the people, and the uniqueness of their situation is what, in fact, determines their response. Right? So the whole research impulse is completely the opposite from the first one. Okay? And so these two things are in tension with each other. Now, biology, see, now one of the reasons that biology was able to deal with this matter is because biology conceptualizes the individual as one of a variety of things. Okay, so in other words, the idea of ideographic presupposes not just that there are individuals, but that each individual is unique. So that's that each individual is a story unto himself. Okay? Now this idea of the uniqueness of individuals is an old theological idea, right? It has to do with each of us having our own souls. You know, each of us, as it were, are saved or damned individually by our own actions. That's where that idea comes from. But biology doesn't have that sense of the individual. For the individual in biology is rather one of a variety of a certain species. So imagine again, right? Homo sapiens reproduce. All of them reproduce, and they produce a population of offspring that range across a variety of traits. Each individual, of course, may be different, but their differences can be compared along a set of specific dimensions. For example, how, you know, you look at 50 people. They're all different heights, but you can compare them. You know they're going to be within a certain range. And you know that range will be predetermined by the genetic predisposition of the parents. So in other words, individual difference can be reduced to variation. That's the biologist's way of handling it. So now you think about this with regard to the traits that we normally consider to be sociologically relevant and how biologists handle them. Intelligence. Right? Intelligence is a great example of this. Right? You know, from an ideographic standpoint, right, intelligence is your ability, your cognitive ability to adapt to your environment. And the way you would think about this from an ideographic standpoint is, well, what kinds of challenges are you facing in your environment? That will then determine the kinds of intelligences that will be flourishing. And each person lives in a slightly different environment, right, in the sense that we don't all do the same things. We do things in common, but we also have things that are just things we do and nobody else does. And it's unlikely that anyone does the same combination of things that we do. So from that standpoint, intelligence, it would seem, from a sociological standpoint, would be a very ideographic concept, one that you really can only get a grip on if you understand the actual life history of the person concerned. But that's not how a biologist thinks about it. And this is where the psychology thing comes in, because the psychologists, especially the experimental psychologists, in the early 20th century, were very much influenced by the biologists on this matter. And so, look at the way in which intelligence then gets conceptualized, where you get the bell curve, right? The idea being that all of these individual differences in people's intelligences can be mapped along common dimensions. So you can tell who's better, who's worse, by how much. And then the range of the differences is something to be explained in genetic terms. So once again, human beings have a genetic predisposition to produce offspring within certain ranges. So just like I said, human being will not produce a cow or produce a creature as dumb as a cow, but at the same time, human beings aren't going to produce some superhuman intelligence either, at least without some kind of enhancement, but that comes after the birth. But the point is, within the birth, there's just going to be a limited range. And then you can map people along that range. So individuality gets reduced the variability. That's the way the biologists handle that issue. Okay? And that's one of the things that's really important. In fact, the thing that, when we talk about the great triumph of the neo-Darwinian synthesis in terms of conceptualizing life, the term that often gets used that's relevant here for seeing how the nomothetic and the ideographic are hooked up is the idea of population thinking. Okay? Population thinking is basically what I've just been describing, namely this idea that a species is not... See, in somebody like Aristotle and the older biologists before Darwin, it was very common to think about a species as basically something that had a common essence. So in other words, if we're all humans, and that's our species, then we're all fundamentally the same in all the most important respects. Now, if you think about species that way, okay, then there's going to be a very strong difference between what's general and what's individual, right? There's going to be species commonality, and then there are going to be these individual differences. Okay? But if you think in terms of populations, then there is no clear distinction between species as a whole and individual members of the species. In other words, a species in population thinking is just a range of individuals who are able to reproduce amongst themselves to produce other individuals who can then reproduce amongst themselves. Okay? So the idea here is we're talking about individuals in a gene pool, as we often say, right? This is where the idea of gene pool comes, population thinking, right? Who are all different, but sufficiently similar that they can mate with each other. So they're all different from each other, but they're not so different that they can't mate. So what that does is that blurs the distinction between some universal species idea of, let's say, human beings, and then some ideographic idea that every human being is radically different from every other human being. Now you see, the social sciences have been very much caught between those two poles, where some people want to talk about all human beings, usually from a normative standpoint. Think about the idea of human rights. Think about most of our normative categories in social life. Human rights is a great example, which presupposes a kind of species uniformity. All human beings, by virtue of being humans, are entitled to this, that, and the other thing. Because that is our nature, and that is how we are able to flourish as beings in the world. Typical human rights stuff. Presupposes uniform notion of humanity. On the other hand, you get these very radical, relativistic approaches, which say every human being's different, all depends on their environments and their particular lives and things like that, and there's no way of coming up with a normative standard for all of them because they're all so different. You've got to judge each in their own terms. That's the ideographic approach. The biological approach is this population thinking. It's in the middle. It looks at basically variation. And this is where you start to get the intelligence test stuff. The intelligence test stuff is in the middle. Because intelligence tests do not presuppose that everybody has the same IQ. And it doesn't presuppose that everybody's IQ is so radically different you can't compare them to each other. Rather, it presupposes variation along a common dimension. Okay, and any other characteristic that can be understood in those kinds of statistical bell curve terms. Right? We talk about the mean and the extremes, right? And we talk about the high end and the low end and the long tail and the short tail and all this kind of stuff, right? That you learn from your statistical inferences class. Okay? This is the thing that really succeeded in biology. To bridge this kind of gap that remains very much in the social sciences. Because you see, to a certain extent, the social sciences have yet to really take on board population thinking. Okay? And that's why you still see among social scientists enormous amount of skepticism about statistics. Especially of the bell curve variety. But this is something that is taken for granted in biology. And it's in fact very instrumental in what enabled the neo-Darwinian synthesis to come together the way it did between the qualitative and quantitative approaches. Okay. Now you may know. I mean, if you're, I think this is a very, very fascinating subject that is worth a lot of further study. Those of you who are interested in this. At the time that Dobzhansky's book is published in 1937, is there anyone in this class that knows a famous sociological work published in 1937 that also attempted to synthesize social science? So in other words, it tried to do exactly what Dobzhansky was trying to do for biology, was trying to do it for social science. It failed, but it was a very famous work. Talcott Parsons, The Structure of Social Action. Okay? Talcott Parsons' Structure of Social Action is written in 1937. It attempted to unify social sciences, economics, sociology, all of them. Okay? And it was trying to bridge the qualitative and the quantitative and all that sort of stuff. And it was very much steeped in the kind of methodological debates that Max Weber and Durkheim and so forth were involved in, where this distinction between nomothetic and ideographic made a big difference. And it failed. And Parsons, not a man to quit easily, kept on pushing this line for basically the rest of his career. That's why he's got this reputation as being a great system builder, great sort of social theorist of the first order kind of guy. Is because he really thought that you could synthesize social sciences to look like something, you know, that had the unity of the neo-Darwinian synthesis. But he failed. He totally failed. And, you know, there are questions can be asked about this. And, of course, one of the most interesting questions to ask, you know, is the sociological question. The difference between the way in which the different fields of biology related to each other and the way in which the people in those fields related to each other, especially given that in biology you actually had more people in key positions who seem to be trained in both traditions. That was an important sociological point. Whereas with Parsons, no matter how hard he tried, he was not able to bring the synthesis together in social science. Okay. We'll stop here. Remember, you don't have a lecture next week. But we shall resume the following week.
Really exciting talk.